drawing its inspiration from the classic 1973 song by The Faces, this episode of the University Registrars and Others Talking About Stuff podcast was a live recording at the Spring Conference of AHUA, the Association of Heads of University Administration, held at Swansea University in April 2025. The recording provides an opportunity to hear from two departing/departed AHUA members in conversation discussing their reflections on their long, long careers in the sector. Featuring Lee Sanders of the University of Birmingham and myself, Paul Greatrix, formerly of the University of Nottingham, the focus is very much on those areas where valuable lessons have been learned. Subjects such as being selective in the battles you pick, the convening power of the registrar, the challenge of complexity and the importance of pragmatism are covered, along with issues such as delivery focus versus PhD acquisition and trying to be serious most of the time. The various attributes needed to survive as a registrar are discussed too, drawing on recent surveys of AHUA members, and some insightful contributions are also provided by the audience. And without getting too maudlin or self-indulgent, the two registrars, former registrars, try to remind everyone that they were the future ones. But actually, things do look much better now for the next stage of development of a more diverse and inclusive AHUA. This is a longer podcast than usual and carries all the features of a live recording. Huge thanks, therefore, to Robin Henderson for providing the equipment and Stella, his daughter, for cleaning up the audio as best she could. So, a landmark event for both AHUA and the University Registrars and Others Talking About Stuff podcast. I do hope you enjoy it.
My starting point for this when I was asked to do it was that had I been, you know, at the beginning of my AHUA career, frighteningly, 18 years ago, and this session had been on, I'd avoided it like the plague, to be honest, right? Because I would have, you know, avoided listening to anything old lags would have had to say, because I'd have thought they could tell me nothing about how to, you know, do my job and live my life. But obviously, things have changed, haven't they, Lee? We've both matured.
Here we have.
And therefore, even though people may not want to listen to anything we're going to say, we're going to bloody say it anyway. So the idea was, so it's things I wish I knew then what I know now. And so what Lee and I have each sort of essentially three things that we think that are things that we wish we'd known then that we do know now. And we'll just go through those three things, and then we've got a few other tips, and then we'll see what other things that the colleagues in the audience can think of. So Lee, your first thing that you wish you'd known now then now.
Okay.
I'm still struggling with a temporal relocation here, but anyway.
I looked even further back to when I started in my career, not just to when I started as a registrar. So you might even get even ancient memory, even more ancient memories here. So look, my first one's perspective. Now this is something that you could easily say comes with experience, the hard knocks of being a registrar or COO. With age, I suppose, through having worked problems, encountered things before that seem similar to the issues in front of you. But I think that's probably the easy thing to say, really. The point I really want to make is that perspective is about, for me anyway, in my own sort of self-reflection and thinking back to when I started my career, I was, for those of you who know me then, I was really quite driven and focused. I must have been a bit of a pain in the neck to work with and know, to be, look at his face, he knows full well. Incredibly task focused, incredibly determined to get things done, to make a difference, to focus in on the job that I had been given, almost at all cost. I was impatient probably for change, I was impatient for results, and I was impatient with others around me. And I suspect over time, through the experience of working in three or four different universities now and having worked with lots of different teams of people, gradually you mellow, I think, and you get a broader perspective on the things that really matter. And this is the central point I want to make. The key is to think beyond yourself. It's not all about you. It is about the stewardship of the university. So in our roles, of all the roles in the senior executive team, particularly now with provosts are no sooner recruited that they're being tapped up to be VCs, pro vice chancellors want to be right. There's a sort of, they're in a hurry to sort of move through the academic ladder. Someone has to think longer term about stewardship and the longevity of the institution. Universities are long-term games. I think the realisation that ultimately it falls to our kind of roles, I think, is important in terms of developing that sense of perspective. And when difficult things come along, and this refers back to Issa's really good point this morning, that even wicked problems, sorry, we'll be in and out of focus, won't we, on this, you know, we all got hit by encampments last year and people got very terribly angst-driven about it, understandably. But actually, these things pass, as Issa says. You know, when you're in the eye of a storm, it might think the most all-consuming thing that matters. But these things do pass. So perspective on a number of different levels linked to stewardship would be my point.
And that is... It's quite difficult to develop that sense of perspective without time and mellowness, as you describe. I do remember you being very task-focused, actually.
Yeah.
Now you mention it. Yeah. But that's not a bad thing, is it?
Well, I don't know, actually. You know, I think you may need a bit of that, but not at all costs.
Okay. No, not at all costs, I think is the important point. But perspective... perspective is certainly something important. The task focusedness one is the reason for picking up on that, Lee, is that's one of my ones, which is I found that I thought that I would progress in my career essentially by people thinking I was really great, and that. By virtue of being where I was and sounding like I did and doing what I did. But actually, people judge you on what you achieve and what you do and what you deliver and those tasks that you actually accomplish. I mean, I spent 10 years doing a PhD part-time, right, because I thought it'd give me academic credibility. And it made not one jot of difference, I don't think. Well, I never got the credibility at all. But such credibility that existed... was, I think, because of actual delivery of meaningful things that added value, rather than, you know, kind of swanning about going on about my qualifications or trying to be, you know, kind of quasi-academic. So for me, actually, focusing on things that mattered to other people and delivering stuff is something that I wish I'd spent more time thinking about at the beginning of my career. Then now it's too late. and I mean, I don't regret doing a PhD, right? But God, 10 years. It was too long. Too long.
Did you ever use it at work?
Well, it's funny you should say that, Lee, because, you know, quality assurance in higher education has never been more relevant.
What was the title again? Can you remind everybody?
It was Dangerous Medicine, The Problems with Quality Assurance in Higher Education. It's still available at some bad bookshops and on Amazon.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Very competitively priced at $2.95. Something good read, according to one person who put a review on.
Your mum.
To be fair, my mum never made it to the end of it. But there's some cracking bits in chapter 9. Anyway, enough of that. But the point is, I you know, actually those things didn't, in the context of being a registrar or being a senior manager in the university, actually it was doing things that delivered the results that the university needed that was more important than the look and the stylings, I think. Anyway, right, enough of that from me. What's your second one, Lee?
Number two, pragmatism. Now, this is another sort of, on a superficial level, you could say it's all about, you know, cutting a deal and knowing when to give a bit and take a bit. But the point I want to make is a bit more, is a bit deeper than that, in the sense that it could be seen as what I'm saying here is that, you know, there's a sort of lack of values and a slight, you know, lack of not caring enough about the institution and the long-term nature of the institution. And indeed, it's fair to say that, again, thinking back to my early career, we were trained to very high standards and to expect very high standards and to be very much focused on the task in hand to get things done. And I could have really done, not just when I was at Warwick in my early days, but when I went to Durham as registrar, I could have really done with a voice in my head saying, step back a bit, you know, think about what really matters beyond the task in hand. Think about the others you're working with. You cannot achieve everything through what your own desire and drive. It has to be through a wider group of people. And there is an element of pragmatism about that, I think, in terms of what you're trying to achieve. And clearly it's linked to experience and the perspective point I made. The more pragmatic you are, it doesn't necessarily mean that you give up on values. I think it's drawing on the experience and the learning you have in order to make sensible decisions about the things that really matters in concert with other people in the institution. So I wished I'd have known a bit more about, if you like, the positive aspects of pragmatism, not just the cutting the deal and knowing when to get things done.
So it's not kind of blowing with the wind.
No.
You're remaining true to yourself.
Possibly, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, do you feel at any point then, without naming the particular situation, I mean, do you feel at any point you've actually had to compromise your values in order to do what seemed to be the right thing in the situation?
Yes, I'm sure that's true of most people, isn't it? Yes, I guess so. Yeah. What about you?
Well, I'm just struggling to think of an example where, you know, I might have... I don't know, to be honest. I mean, I think possibly, yeah. I can't think of a particular example, but I guess it's the kind of thing that other people would point out to me that would say, I didn't think you would go along with that. But I think, I mean, related to that issue, though, it says he's dodging it because I can't think of anything. I mean, I think consistency in terms of, you know, your approach is actually really important. So even if you do change your position,
yes,
actually, if you're consistent in terms of your attitude and your stance...
consistently pragmatic.
Yeah, pragmatically consistent. It's sound advice, Lee. So my again, follows a little bit on from what you just said, which is about... So when I started at Nottingham, and I was very excited, and... There was an executive board, management board every Monday, you know, went on for 3 hours, and there were a dozen papers or whatever at every board. And right, I can remember turning up and thinking, I disagree with everything here, you know. So I started out arguing about everything. And of course, me immediately made myself wildly unpopular because every single one of these things was championed by someone else in the room. And whether they were a good idea or a bad idea, I was against all of it because, you know, I knew what the answer was and they didn't have it and I was right and they were wrong. And after a couple of months of this, I eventually realised that this wasn't going to work if I carried on like that. And I had to be a bit more selective in fighting those battles.
How much of that came from the fact that you'd worked at Warwick for a long time and you rocked up at Nottingham and thought, well, we wouldn't have done it like we did it at Warwick?
A awful lot of it was like that. And it was very much about the attitude, but also, you know, the confidence and arrogance of youth thinking that I did actually know what the answers were. Well, of course I did, and I still do. But it was that kind of that confidence and the confidence that Warwick did breed in you about the attitude and the approach to take. And I remember not long after I'd arrived, 6 months or so after I arrived, I went out for lunch with a former colleague from Warwick, and we had a chat and whatever. And he stopped, you know, halfway through lunch, and he said at one point, he said, "God, are you planning on leaving?" Right, because you've just slagged off your own university for the past half an hour, and you know, it sounds like you really hate it. And of course, I didn't. I really liked it, and I was really proud, and you know, to be doing the things I was doing. But being cross and angry about everything was going to achieve nothing. So actually, being much more selective about the things I went into. Also, they come round every couple of years anyway. You get another go. And then you, you know, if you stick around long enough, you see everything at least twice.
Yeah, that is very true. Yeah.
Right, what's your third one then?
All right, complexity. Look, complexity is important. So what do I mean by that? So when I started back in the day in 1990 at Warwick, guess what the turnover of Warwick University was in 1990? Have a guess.
70 million.
That's a good guess. A little bit more than that. 83 million. Yeah, a lot more than that now. How many students were at Warwick in 1990?
3,500.
No, more than that.
9,000.
Yeah, it's about nearly 9,000. Yeah, and I think about the size of Warwick now, and even when I went to Durham, it was bigger than that in 2003. And of course, now I'm at Birmingham. Was it 1.1 million? And
that's a lot of students, Lee.
45,000 students. So, look, the obvious point to make is that the sector is infinitely more complicated and infinitely bigger, infinitely more global and civic and everything that's expected of it in the 30 or so years, if you look back on things. Now, one advantage we both had, I suppose, in the Warwick sort of training style, you were moved around every 5 minutes, it seemed, at the time. So it's not that I didn't feel when I went to Durham that, you know, probably in a slight degree of arrogance about this, that I didn't feel prepared to go on to do the job in another university, because I'd worked in several different departments, you know, not just academic services, research services, personnel, even a bit of estates work, faculty work, school work. So I've worked around the institution, but it was only one institution. And I think when I went to Durham, and certainly then I found the same when I went to Birmingham, is nothing quite prepares you, I think, for the step up in complexity for the next job or on a broader stage. And if I think back at it, yes, it was a difficult gig going from Warwick to Durham at that stage and learning the ropes there. And I think it was jolly useful I did that. I don't think I could have done the Birmingham job without having done the Durham step. But it was just as big a step when I went from Durham to Birmingham. And it takes you a long time to get your head around that complexity. And if you then compound that with the complexity of everything that's happening in the sector, it is worth just occasionally stepping back and reflecting on that complexity, not in a way that I think is going to phase or scare you, but just so you can think of reaching out and seeking support in navigating it. So it's an obvious point, but I think it is a difference between even now and when I was at Durham, you know, nearly 20 years ago. The complexity of it all and the pace of it all is something I wished I'd have taken more time to reflect upon, I suppose is what I'm saying.
And I mean, thinking about, I agree with all of that, Leah, but thinking about how you kind of respond to that and how you deal with it. Because, again, I mean, part of my naivety in starting out was an assumption that somehow I could understand literally everything if only I put my mind to it and, you know, paid attention enough. I could get my arms around everything. But you can't. You can never do that. It is too complex and too big and too diverse. So the kind of coming to terms with that, I think, is quite difficult. But you've got to reflect on it, yes. But then you've got to work out how you navigate it.
So can I have a fourth, which ties all these together?
Yeah, go on then.
So the other thing I think I wish I'd have known then, that I sort of know now, but I wouldn't necessarily say I'm super skilled in it, is the one thing you have as a registrar is the ability to convene people. And it seems so obvious, doesn't it? But you know, I think it's a mistake to place too much emphasis on the authority of the office, particularly in this day and age. But one thing you can gain from the position you're in is the ability to convene people. And whether it's gaining perspective, thinking about pragmatic solutions, learning from others about the complexity of a new institution, you've got to convene people. And I'm not just talking about committees or that kind of thing. I think about the art of administration is knowing when and who to bring together, when to bring people together and who to bring together in order to try and navigate the ways and means of a solution in the institution, which will be different depending on the rhythms and of that particular institution. And the whole gamut, its inherited tradition of making difficult decisions. And I think it's an overlooked skill, really. And as I say, even now, I'm not sure I'm the best at it. Bringing people together, convening the right people for the right purpose.
Yeah.
And the one thing you can bring is a degree of steerage to that. So that's what I would say is an underpinning fourth theme.
Okay.
How about that, Paul?
Okay, you're going to destroy the structure, Lee. But the because my, going back then to my third one,
yeah,
which was actually does relate to builds on one of your points actually, which is about and you're going to think this is everyone's going to think this is ridiculous, but I do think it's important, and it goes back to as well the idea of behaviour and how you act in the role, and picking fights on everything, right? You end up looking pretty stroppy and pretty childish a lot of the time, and actually behaving more as a grown up and having more gravitas, behaving seriously. I mean, I have a fundamental weakness, which is if there is an opportunity to respond to any point made with a gag, no matter how bad, how inappropriate, or how poorly timed, it's all that I can do to stop myself doing it, right?
You've always been good at that, though.
Yeah, well, you see, you say good, right? I mean, it's not really a character trait that right. is particularly useful on the whole. And the last place you want to exercise it is in a meeting of council yeah. or university executive board, because no one thanks you for it there. And you just look like a smart aleck, right? And nobody likes a smart aleck, right? And so actually learning not to do that,
yeah.
to bottle my basis instincts and not go for the gag, even if it was presented on a silver platter, I think was a really important lesson that it took me, you know, quite a long time to learn. I mean, there's a danger you do end up sounding, you know, pretty staid and boring and pompous. But the way I always think about it is that there are loads of opportunities with your teams, you know, informal social activities, or indeed outside the university environment altogether, to have a laugh about stuff. So there are plenty of other times when you can crack the gags, which are always terrible. It's not like that good, you know. It's not like, you know, it's brilliant bombo, which have been, you know, prevented from getting out there into the world that everyone's poorer for it. You know, this is stupidity, or at least, you know, not very adult behaviour. Anyway, so don't do it, guys. You know, is my.
What about sort of just thinking about that point about it's gravitas, experience. Dealing with difficult situations, it could be the executive board meeting, it could be the council meeting, it could be a staff forum. What about the kind of the ability to know when to make your intervention?
I think that's a really good point, because again, in my enthusiastic younger days, I'd always be right in there. You'd want to be the first. I mean, there can be advantages to being the first to respond, because you can set the tone, you can also set the direction. And you know, shape the argument. It's also high risk, because it means that you've used all your weapons in one go, and then you've got nothing else to offer. So actually, listening to what other people have to say, even if you think they're talking nonsense, and coming in late is often a much better strategy. Coming in right at the end can be decisive, particularly if you become the person that the chair looks to for the decisive position, which they can then endorse.
Yeah.
And you are the wise one in the room.
Yeah.
I like being the wise one, and it rarely happens, but it's a good place
to be.
You
get a better kick out of being the wise one in the room or the funniest one in the room.
Ultimately, it's better to be known for your wisdom
than your wit.
Than your stupidity. Yeah, would that it were wit. But I do think that that point about timing is a good one. Yeah. And I mean, it relates to another point which I was going to make, which is not dissimilar, which is that, so you mentioned earlier, you know, the kind of crises that we all face, right? And, you know, we've all seen lots of crises, and you kind of know how to deal with them, right? And they're always a bit different. But broadly, you know the steps that you're going to take in relation to any particular event. But all the other people in the room, it might be their first one, right? And there's always panic, and particularly if it's you know you're talking about a room of senior academics, particularly who've never experienced an occupation or a fire or whatever it might be. So being the grown up. Being the mature, responsible adult in the room, who is not losing it at all when others are going to pieces is, again, I think another important part of the role, even if you don't feel it, right? Someone has got to look like they are responsible, even if you think, what the hell am I going to do in this situation now that they're burning the vice chancellor's furniture or whatever it might be. You've got to at least look in control,
yeah.
Because then everyone else will feel confident. Moving along, Lee, you'll recall that a couple of years ago, AHUA produced a really interesting booklet on, you know, registrars and all that they do. It's a kind of reprise of an earlier one, I think, from 20...
Written by a very witty, wise colleague.
To be clear, I think I did the title and other people wrote it all, so I can claim no contributions from me and in that. But the thing that, I mean, I think it's well worth reading, but what it does is, from the AHUA membership, shows that, you know, the kind of attributes that people feel that a registrar, yeah, COO needs now to survive and to manage, you know, are, you know, aligned with, I think, the things that we've been talking about, but also things that you would advise anyone starting out in the profession to recognise that this is what they needed. And we'll come on in a bit, I think, to talk about how things have changed. But the kind of core ones that I picked out from the 2023 survey, resilience, you know, absolutely. Yeah. And this, you know, you have to be, you know, there and you have to keep going. People skills, I mean, you talked about convening power. And I talked about, you know, annoying the heck out of people. But actually, engaging with people in a constructive, meaningful way and being able to deal with them and management is really, really, really important at all levels within the organisation. Leadership of a diverse group. And political acumen. I think that's something we haven't touched on, which is actually really important. And it goes down to, you know, reading the room and understanding where the alliances are among other members of the executive, being clear about who you're going to make friends with on this particular issue, where the challenges to you on your particular issue might come from. And it struck me that those were particularly resonant ones. I mean, communication always comes up, you know, building relationships always comes up. But those, I think, were real standout items for me.
Stolen all my best lines.
Oh, right. Okay, sorry.
No, I agree with all of those. What could I add to it? Adaptability, I suppose, given the complexity, fast pace of change, all the rest of it. I think we have to be super adaptable and model that, I suppose. That's been something I found difficult to do. The more experienced you are, the more you've seen situations before, there is always a risk that you will say, tried that before, it hasn't worked. You know, so you have to pick your moment about how you do those things. But I think adaptability is absolutely key. Not just adaptability through the elements of the role, but importantly, how adaptable are you to change in vice chancellor, which is, let's face it, point of critical risk for most of our roles, and or change the chair of the governing body for those that have a very strong sort of governance focus to their positions. But I think, you know, I think, I don't know, we compare notes. I think I've worked with 7 vice chancellors now, all of them tremendously different individuals.
So as registrar?
No, as academic registrar or registrar,
right,
probably,
okay.
If you add them all up. 5 as registrar. 2 or more. So, you know, reasonably close relationships, which were important relationships. Each of them have been very different. And almost subconsciously, I suppose, over the time, I found myself seeking to adapt more. So even though I might be working with people who are less experienced than I am, you've got to use that experience to be adaptable and consciously adaptable, I think.
So on that adaptability, I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, they are unequivocally your boss.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's up to them how they decide to use you to best effect. And, yeah, so you do have to bend to their will.
It's about using your adaptability to know when to intervene with them and have that quiet private word to say, you know, actually, you thought about doing it a different way. What a great idea, but we could do it a different way.
Yeah.
It's that kind of adaptivity.
I think you're... I couldn't agree more, Lee. I think you're absolutely right. Unfortunately, neither of us have ever been in a position where we've had to caution a vice chancellor for what they're doing, have we? So that's really good. Of course, there is an esteemed member of the association who sadly isn't at this conference, who is in the unique position in the sector of having to ask two vice chancellors tell two vice chancellors they had to resign. We won't name him to spoil his blushes, but that. It struck me when I first heard about him doing it for the first time. That must be the most extraordinarily difficult role that any registrar could have to play. When he did it twice, I thought, hang on a second. And when he still got appointed by other vice chancellors to job as a registrar, wow. I thought, what do they know? Anyway, he's not done it for years.
Don't make a habit of it.
No. So I think, you know, but you're absolutely right. It is about adapting to what the boss, how they want you to work and how they want you to work with them and what their styles are. And if, you know, if you don't like it, you've got options, haven't you?
Yeah, they'll move.
Yeah.
So can only be one winner in that one. The other thing, it's a variant of, what did you call it, political now?
Political.
I wrote organisational now. So I do think that's something that we all need to develop, really. And I wish I had more of when I was younger, less experienced. It's being able to kind of navigate, as I say, the rhythms of the particular institution. I think you talked about forming the right kind of alliances. That's very true. Part of our job is to actually help get decisions made and implemented, isn't it? If you absolutely boil down to it, I think that's sometimes overlooked in the focus on the delivery of the service. But often as not, there's a preliminary stage about, you know, convening people, debating the policy, and then part and parcel of that, working out the ways and means of getting that decision landed in the institution, particularly if it's a controversial institution. And I've always put a lot of effort into that. Maybe that's just me. I think that's pretty important, particularly as you could be the one person that knows the way in which you need to navigate the path for approval, and then after that, obviously the implementation of it. That seems to me an important dimension of the organisational analysis. It's organisational analysis for a purpose.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that occurred to me as you were talking there, Lee, was that it's actually very rare. To get credit for anything, isn't it? If you do something really well, you might get a nod or a pat on the back, but more likely someone else will be doing the press release and have the article in the staff newsletter about them. And that's great, and that's lovely, and that's the way it should be, really, isn't it? Because we're team players, aren't we?
We are.
And we're not resentful at all anyone else claiming credit for our work. But it is a fact of life, and I can remember being a bit miffed about it, right? But it is part of the deal, I think, that actually, you know, fundamental to what you're doing a lot of the time is enabling and supporting others to do the best that they can. And actually, it doesn't really matter whether they're a relatively junior member of staff or a pro vice chancellor. It's them that's going to be the person who gets the credit for it. And that's, you know, rightly so. And it doesn't really matter if the right result is achieved at the end of the day. You know in your heart you did all the work.
So just thinking about the point you just made there, Paul. Like, here's perhaps an example of what I mean. We perhaps both mean by this point. So if you've got a contentious issue, something that's gone wrong in a university that you need to fix, often is not the way these things pan out is that people sit around the table. Universities are brimful of people with amazing critical minds, so they'll critique the problem, they'll analyse the problem, they'll problematise the problem, and they will think that is the job, to do the analysis and the critiquing. Someone needs to say, that's great, we need to now move on, think about how we're going to move forward from this and find a positive solution to the issue. Work the problem to a purpose in order to land it, not simply stop at problematizing it. And that's something what I sort of mean by the craft here. If that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I absolutely. And it comes back to one of your original points, which is, you know, we are trying to make things happen. We are trying to be there for a purpose and to ensure that the university delivers on every aspect of its mission. And that's where ultimately the satisfaction comes from, isn't it? It's having the university succeed, having the people within it succeed, having everyone do the best that they can for the university, and providing the environment in which academics can do their best work, and students can make the most of the opportunity, and you can contribute most to the region and the town that you live in. I mean, it's, you know, it's not much to ask, is it? When you and I, well, you preceded me, obviously, into AHUA because you've been a registrar for, you know, what, for how long? When did you start at Durham then?
2003.
So you did it for, you've been in AHUA for 4 years before, so you, 22 years. Yeah, that's what Nicola said.
Yeah.
At the dinner, didn't she? Right. So it's 22 years, 22 glorious years. But the point is, AHUA was a different organisation then. And for those of you who haven't read John Hogan's lovely history of the AHUA, it's well worth reading. It's on the AHUA website. But it tells you, you know, from the foundings of the organisation back in 1939, that just predates Lee and myself, right up to the present day. But the thing that you get the very, very strong sense of from the period, the very earliest days, right through to, you know, the early 2000s, right, is a staggeringly undiverse, middle-aged, bloke-driven organisation, right? It looks like a golf club.
Fuck us.
Well, yeah, exactly. Obviously, when we were thinking about now, then, when we were younger, then that was what we were kicking against, you see, Lee. We were transforming that organisation to what it has become now that we're leaving it, much better, and much better for our departure. But my point about it is that the registrars, CEO, secretaries are a much more diverse group, and that's infinitely better than it was back even only 20 years ago. And I think that means something very different for the organisation, for AHUA itself, but it also means something different for the way in which, you know, the profession as a whole develops, and I think it's all for the good.
Yeah. All of the above, I think. I agree with all of that. Yeah, it's remarkable to look back at. I mean, Hogan's history was really good, wasn't it, in sort of revealing all of this. It has transformed, and there have been a number of moments. There was the expansion of the sector in the 1990s, yeah. And the bringing in of the totality of the sector beyond the older university sector. That was an important moment, predated us being involved. And then I think, you know, certainly in the last decade to 15 years, there's been a diversification of membership, not just organisationally, but I actually think the roles have changed as well. Is that something you'd like to talk about, Paul?
Well, there they have. But I wasn't going to talk about that, Lee, but I'm glad you mentioned it. Because, again, referring back to the role of the registrar, I mean, what that comprehensively sets out is actually how the role has changed even over the past 5 years among the membership, right? And it is essentially lots of roles are very different. They're differently constructed. There's there are elements to many roles around governance and the kind of stewardship stuff you're talking about. But there's lots of diversity out there in terms of the role. But there's also a lot more turnover than there used to be as well, and that can make it feel a bit precarious at times as well. But the thing I was going to come back to was the value of AHUA as an organisation, yes, to its members, yeah, because all the things that we have now, the action learning sets, the training programs of one kind or another, all the different group discussions that happen, and the coaching, you know, the kind of development dimension of it, which is really aimed at supporting members, I think is really positive. And again, that was only in its infancy when I started, and you probably didn't benefit from. I'm sure you would have benefited had it been available, but
it wasn't available.
But all of that now exists and is a really important part of the offer, I think, and that's fantastic too. The thing I'm disappointed about, Lee, is we had a fantastic program that was established by AHUA a decade or so ago called Ambitious Futures,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Which was based on a scheme which had been developed in Nottingham, which also existed in a number of other universities as well, a graduate training program where you got people who were, you know, fresh-faced graduates or recent sabbatical officers or even not so fresh-faced graduates, but they did a, you know, a program of learning over an 18-month period, including a stint at another university as well, and learned three different roles within an 18-month period before hopefully getting a role. But the group of people who went through that, and it was all killed by COVID because it all fell apart because we couldn't do it during COVID. And I do hope that at some point AHUA will revive it. It just needs a champion, and it's a scheme anxious for revival. Because what it did was identify a cadre of people who loved higher education, loved universities, loved working in them, loved the idea of working in professional services in the university, and desperately wanted to build a career which would see them ending up as the most senior administrator in the university. They were all ambitious for their future. Oh, that was the title of the program, wasn't it? They were all genuinely ambitious to make a career in universities. And the enthusiasm for that I've never seen anywhere else. It was absolutely fantastic and utterly infectious. So I do hope it comes back, because it's a thing that, you know, it's about the future of our profession. And, you know, they made it, and we need many more of them. So it's, I'm sorry it died during COVID, but I do hope it comes back someday.
Look, I think you deserve a lot of credit, Paul, for having pushed a number of these programmes, and particularly the Ambitious Futures programme, which I know you can see is passionate about. I think if we're looking to the future in all of this, because not every institution can afford a generously found graduate training programme, which is effectively what we're talking about here. So the idea was pull your efforts and see what you can do. And even that is a challenge. Doing some work recently comparing approaches in the US and the UK to professional development. And what is really striking, you probably, forgive me, many of you will know this, that the way in which most universities in America populate their junior ranks as administrators is through master's students doing a two-year master's program part-time in higher education leadership management, often with a specialism for student affairs, because it's such a big deal in American universities, student advisory services. In return, they get a fees remission and they get a graduate assistantship stipend and spend 2 years being moved around. Sounds familiar? Mm. The administration doing different jobs. This would be equivalent to a sort of grade six-ish sort of role in our money, or, you know, entry grade role. They come out of it with a master's degree at the end, which is the entry ticket to develop a career in university administration in most US universities. At the senior end, they still do bring people in from other sectors, obviously, particularly in specialist disciplines. But for those who want to work in more mainstream administration, or indeed fundraising, or indeed student advisory services, or counselling, or marketing, those sorts of things, they will typically develop their graduates that way. Most universities of my scale, the University of Maryland I was talking to last week, 50, 60 graduates of that kind a year. That's wow. The scope of it. Not all of them get a job at the end of it, of course. They will often have to compete and go on to other things. But it is quite interesting to contrast, if you like, the very over professionalism to career development, starting at a very junior, you know, very recent graduate level. Maybe they've done a bit of working in the university administration as an intern or part-time work as a student or a grad student. They'll do this as a way in. And then that will be topped up by some of the more senior professional development programs that are a million miles away from the aspiring registrars, that kind of thing. I mean, maybe that's something that we would never get to, because they've got the scale, perhaps wealthier institutions, maybe they can afford the investment. They don't do it to make money. They do it in a way to populate the professional workforce. Yeah. So you don't see thousands of international students populating those programs. Well, you couldn't if you think about it, because they're doing 2 years, part-time degrees, visa problems and so forth. Very different model of professional development. And I hadn't realised until talking to some of these US universities very recently about it. Yeah. So maybe there is the other thing is these programmes tend to be supportive, not accredited, but supported by standards that are laid down by the equivalent of the AHUA. We heard about the Canadian version this morning. They will tend to write the standards of professional development they expect to see from these master's programmes at the different levels. So there is a symbiotic relationship between the universities and the professional associations. So maybe there is a future for us, for our futures, in that model.
Brilliant. Well, it sounds very exciting. I like the idea of AHUA as an accrediting organisation programmes around.
I can see you as chief accreditor.
Oh, I'm already excited, Lee. So Right, we've been talking for far too long now. If anyone, and you don't have to ask a question, you can make a contribution.
Thank you, Andrea Bolshaw from the University of Brighton. That was really interesting. Thank you for sharing that wisdom. I just want to focus in on the stewardship and perspective that you talked about, Lee, and that seniority and great responsibility that comes with the role. And if you could give yourself advice earlier on in terms of, the stakes and that imposter syndrome that you might have felt. Could you talk a bit about that, perhaps for the benefit of, somebody like me who experiences that and, hopefully can learn from your response. Thank you.
Thanks. I'm sure Paul can chip in as well. Look, I'm not sure I've got a particular wisdom about this. Because we've all suffered that, haven't we, in imposter syndrome. As you were speaking, I had that feeling of arriving in Durham for the first day of registrar and going into Ken Cameron's office, who's the vice chancellor at the time, and thought, golly, what have I let myself in for? So we all feel that. Can I even do this job? And my wife remembers me coming home and me saying, Ken expects me to run the university. Yeah, that was the time, only dawning on me. There was no sort of I'm the chief executive. It was more I'm the chair of the board. You're going to sort it out. In that day and age. So we've all. I can empathise with what you're saying. What can I say? What I would say is what helped me was knowing who to go to for help and advice. It's a lonely job, isn't it, when you're in our roles? It is a really lonely job. So you've got to find ways of looking after yourself. And I might not have articulated it back in the day, but, there's a well-being point to all of this as well, because if you're not doing too well, it's going to rub off on your staff and everyone around you and so forth. But so you've got to look to where you're going to get your help, sources of help and advice. That's the first thing I would say, both to reassure you and say, look, it's okay to feel this way, but actually just to listen to you when you just want to sound off about something in private. So I was fortunate in that I had two or three colleagues that I knew very well in the sector that were much more experienced than me. I'll give you the name of someone, David Holmes, who is now long retired, who was, when he retired, registrar at Oxford, but had been at Birmingham, actually, one of my predecessors, before that, Liverpool and Warwick, so we'd moved around. Just the sort of person who, would listen and often wouldn't say very much, but it was a great source of just comfort being able to have those conversations, mentoring type conversations. That's good. So know who to go to. Friends, interests, you've got to live your life. You don't go to work just to work. Well, I tried to tell myself that you work to live, and you've got to try and live with your family. And I mentioned Ken before. Ken Cowman was a tremendous chap, I thought, really lovely man. And one of the best pieces of advice he ever had to me when I started at Durham is, think of your wee family, he would always say.
Was he Scottish?
He was. Right. Think of your wee family. And a lovely kind of sort of human point, really. Think of those moments of small joy you take with your family when you're in the bleakest moments at work. That's why you're living and working. So those sort of small things are really helpful, to me anyway. Look, you've got a great group of people in this room that you can go to. This is what this is all about, isn't it? It's about all of us feeling imposters and helping each other realise that actually, we can draw collective strength from it, really. So it's not... I don't have much to offer than that, really, but it's... that's what I would say. What about you, Paul?
Well, I was just going to reinforce the point about AHUA's value as a network in that, both the people that most locally within the regional groupings, but anyone in the association, because everyone's been through everything, one way or another. We've all seen enough, and everyone knows what it's like to be isolated or on your own and not have anyone you can talk to. So, there is just about anyone you can go to here. And I think, it's much easier to talk to a fellow COO registrar than it is necessarily to talk to anyone. And, VCs have their networks, PVCs have their networks as well. This is, what our sector is like, really. And it's a real positive, I think. There's always people willing to
to listen and to advise and to help. And certainly I've called on people, particularly in the early days, for advice. And they did very well as well. I believe.
Thank you. So you talked about stewardship of institutions, and I really like that as a terminology of our roles. Given that you've spent a big chunk of your careers in what could be termed as the golden age for HE, if you weren't departing stage left at this stage, what would be your advice for your future self on how disruptive and how to weather the storm so that actually there are brilliant institutions for others to steward in the future?
So if I look back at the golden age, by which I think we mean well-funded age, I think it really only began around 2012 when the fees came in. They made a big difference initially. And that coincided with a very big take-up in international student recruitment. And it also coincided with much more significant, well, the Brown Blair governments has started more investment in research. That's certainly true, but it did take off. All of that was super helpful, and undoubtedly you're right. We moaned and groaned and would often critique, but actually we never had it so good in terms of... But if I look back to the 90s, you were really existing on margins then, particularly with the unit costs for students. I think when I started at Birmingham, and Birmingham had a reputation for being a very well-run university financially, great credit to someone called Jill Ball, who was the finance director when I arrived, fantastic, fantastic, wise colleague. Another person who I often used to seek advice from in my early days, great, great woman. And I remember when I arrived there, what would be called an EBITDA then, was only about 4%. And that was the Hefke guidance, if you look back to the first 10 years of this century, was about a 3 to 5% margin. So the universities, this predates the took off in fees that we started to see the double digit EBITDA margins, and then we slammed it all into capital investment and hiring fellows and things, and funding generous welfare services. But I think it's, if you look back to the first decade of this century, and certainly in the 1990s, we were existing more on margins. So we were working with leaner administrations, actually. So it placed a greater emphasis on the quality of people you hired and what you expected them to do. So perhaps we need to rediscover all of that. Not everything can be sorted out for you by the press of a button with a student record system. Sometimes you have to roll up your sleeves and work the problem. It may be labour intensive. So maybe we need to resurface some of those old habits. What else would I say? I'd like to repeat what I was trying to say earlier on, that however difficult it's going to get, I think there are some of us, our roles, where some of us at least have to stay calm and measured and trying to think for the long term. And I think my final remark would be, and this is not my idea, but something that I heard the other day when we were talking about transformation in another sector, you've got to hold out the vision of hope. You've got to hold out a vision of hope for change. You know, you've got to be honest about the savings you need to make and the cuts you need to make or the restructuring you need to make, but it has to be, you have to represent it in a way that shows a sunnier upland. The best transformations of NHS hospitals have not been, even when they've been absolutely down in the depths of deficit, have been those that have been able to convince the doctors and the nurses and the staff that ultimately we're doing this because there is a vision of hope for improving healthcare at the end of the day. So some kind of analogy like that. I'm sorry that sounds a bit twee, but I really do believe that, because when you're in the moment, it's all about the cuts of the short term. You've got to think long term, I think.
Yeah, no, I would endorse that, Lee. I mean, when going back to the very beginning of my career, I can remember when I started working, there were people who were still talking about and who still felt scarred by the cuts imposed by the Thatcher government in 1981. And those cuts were genuinely draconian. They were announced in 1981 and implemented in the following couple of years. It was a total, and bearing in mind that higher education
smaller sector, but it was entirely funded by government at that point. So it was a 15% cut to universities' funding. And they asked the University Grants Committee to allocate that cut across the universities, which they set up a committee in order to deliberate and decide. And that committee treated some universities much worse than others. So places like Salford, who was the worst affected, had a 44% cut to its funding, introduced effectively overnight. Mm. Lost a lot of staff, shut down a lot of courses. But it survived, right? It's still there. It's still surviving and thriving. It undoubtedly was a big setback for the university, but actually, it's still going. And all the other universities, and places like Aston had a cut not quite as deep as that, but it was still pretty big. St Andrews, Aberdeen, they had big cuts as well. But they're still thriving as well. So my point is, this is an incredibly resilient sector, right? It may feel painful, but institutions have come through bigger challenges than this before, survived the crash back in 2009, 2010, survived COVID. It's been tough. It may be tougher yet, but actually there is positives on the other side. And it's really about, as Lee said, presenting that vision of hope and opportunity for the kind of institution that we will be in a couple of years' time. We have to make these necessary changes now in order to come through in better shape. And I think that the resilience thing is really, really important, because universities, you know, some of them have been around for 800, you know, more years. Some of them are much more recent. But actually, organisationally, they are very, very resilient organisations.
Our Canadian colleague earlier on had a really a great phrase, because they're going through a lot of cuts at the moment. Think about it in the round as mission sustainability, not simply financial sustainability. I wrote that down. I thought it was quite a nice way of trying to summarise that combination of ambition, hope, not letting go of that. Thinking about what you're trying to aim for rather than just the short term. I thought that was a nice phraseology.
Sean Horan, Halpin Partnership, now Huron Consulting. You've touched a little bit on this, but it'd be good to know who the most important people have been in your careers and why.
We'll probably say the same people.
You go first.
Okay. Well, obviously, Lee's been very important to me in my career. I mean, because we both worked at the University of Warwick, I had some really powerful direction from a couple of individuals there, Mike Shattuck, who appointed me, and Jonathan Nichols, who succeeded him. Sadly, no longer with us. But they were both huge figures in terms of advice and guidance and role modelling as well, and incredibly supportive. Before that, someone else who'd grown up in the Warwick mode was my mentor and boss at UEA. Is a guy called Tony Rich, who was an outstanding leader and could not have been more supportive to me in the early days of my career, and protected me and advised me and corrected me on more occasions than I can account. But I owe him a huge amount. But also all the vice chancellors I've worked with, to be honest, one way or another, I've learned from all of them. But I would come back to the people within, this association who, people like, John Hogan as well. And our current chair, Nicola has mentioned before that, I was, actually her first boss when she started at UEA. I always feel I've learned a lot more from her than the other way around. And, I've been privileged to work with some very, very good and able people, but also to have those great mentors as well.
Yeah, great. I could say similar things about all the great colleagues that we sort of grew up with at Warwick, but I won't. And there's no doubt about it. Mike was just exceptional. I'd like to think further back, who was the person that really got me into university administration, and that was my PhD supervisor, someone called Rosemary Morris, who is a Byzantine historian. Yeah. So started my career studying Byzantine and Crusader history. And I always wanted to be an academic back in the 1980s, working at Manchester, doing a bit of teaching and research and stuff. And I'd been applying for jobs. And as Paul said, this was in the 1980s when there weren't many jobs around at all. And I was getting frustrated. And Rosemary could see that. And she pulled me one side and said, have you ever thought about university administration? I've been sort of active in student politics. I didn't hold a position or anything. So she knew I was someone who was, she would say, a bit of a nosy Parker about how universities worked and what they were about. But also, as well, I think, beyond that, really, about the purpose of higher education. So she persuaded me to think about applying for university administrative roles. And this is the small world bit. A friend of hers had been the PhD supervisor of Tony Rich, who Paul referenced, who wanted to be an academic, but then moved into administration. So I actually spoke to Tony, and he said, hey, I'll have a think about it. So I applied at the same time for two jobs, one a lectureship in medieval studies, which is always what I wanted to do, and another one at Warwick. And I can't tell you to this day why ultimately I chose the Warwick administrative assistant role in 1990 rather than the other job in terms of the three lectureships. That's what I'd always wanted to do, but I did. And all I can say is I'd worked out on the map that Warwick was closer to where my girlfriend lived in London than Newcastle. So that's why I got into it. So Rosemary, God bless you. I'm possibly a better administrator than I would be an academic. But so she was super important in my life, for all sorts of reasons about who I was and confidence that she helped build in me. The other person that I think I'd like to mention, I mentioned him several times because he's just such a wonderful human being, is Ken Cowman at Durham. By his own admission, he wasn't the sort of, he did his vice chancellorship in a certain way. He was former chief medical officer. He had more of that kind of approach. But he was just, he really taught me the value of human relations in leadership, just by the way he was. And I'll always be grateful for him for that. And then I've been just so privileged to work with some fantastic vice chancellors. I'm not just saying that. I mean, they've all wobbled because learned. No, I really mean it. It's an easy thing to trip off the tongue. I mean, David Eastwood, the Vice-Chancellor of Vice-Chancellors, amazing, amazing guy, fantastic. Genuinely, it's often said of people, fantastic strategic leader. He really was a fantastic strategic leader, a wonderful chap. Adam is an outstanding Vice-Chancellor, very different model of leadership. Really enjoyed working with him. But all the Vice-Chancellors I've worked with, I've learned a lot from, and all my colleagues. But probably the person who set me most on my course and helped form me is Rosemary, my old PhD supervisor.
Lovely. Lee, are there any final reflections on what you wish you knew then that you know now?
You'll never know everything, really, and don't think you do. It's not all about you.
That's lovely. And I'm going to pick a quote from the AHOA report, which was, I don't know who made this comment, but I do like it, which is, don't be a robot, which was quite nice. I've never worried about that.
Robots, now here's a funny one. When I was at Durham, I inherited one of those little electronic Daleks. I think, was it John Hogan that left it on my desk? It was like a little Dalek. You remember those? And it was like a command Dalek. And when you press the top, it used to say things like, destroy the doctor. It was very useful. So there was a robotic element to it. I left it for my successor, and it didn't work well.
Well, I never. So the one other thing I meant to mention is in terms of networks. Obviously, AHOA is a fantastic network. Other networks exist too, which can also be sources of support, counsel, and advice, as well as tremendous fun. And earlier today at the conference, we heard from Asa Hamalainen and from University of Helsinki, who is in the room. but Asa was a former president of Humane, which is the heads of administration in universities in Europe. So organisation I've always also been a president on. But that kind of organisation as well offers a different vehicle for engaging with peers from a broader constituency, which can be incredibly valuable as well, particularly again in the early days of careers. So, you know, having other networks to turn to is also extremely valuable. And then finally, turning to, I finally discovered the lyrics of the song from which this title is taken, Ooh La La by The Faces. A couple of lyrics. Poor old granddad. I laughed at all his words. I thought he was a bitter man. Poor young grandson. There's nothing I can say. You'll have to learn just like me. And that's the hardest way. I wish that I knew what I know now when I was younger. God, I still...
Well, that's all for this time. There is lots more where that came from. You can search for University Registrars Talking About Stuff on the internet. And you might want to listen to the sister podcast too, My Imaginary University, where notable sector figures create and describe that ideal imaginary institution. It's a sort of Desert Island Discs University's concept, but without the desert island, the music, the book, or the luxury. Again, you can search for it online or head over to my website, wonderfulhighered.com, where you can find links to all of this and much more higher education entertainment. Until the next time then, thanks for listening.